Good morning. Good morning and welcome. You are on 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel and it is time for Final Draft. Every Saturday morning, I get a half hour to share exciting new books with you, and I relish the opportunity. Today is no different. I've got a couple of fantastic new Australian novels, and it's the perfect time of the year to be reading. You might be getting excited about Christmas and looking for books for friends, relatives, getting excited about having a little bit of time to read. Of course, the days are warming up. It's now sort of, we're having a bit of cool weather in the warm days instead of a little bit of warm weather on the cold days. So there's just so much to be happy about. I kind of love the jacarandas being in bloom as well. But enough about the weather. I can't believe I just did small talk in the intro to my show. Enough about the weather. I do have books today on the show. Final Draft producer Jennifer Worgan is bringing us a fantastic new Australian book by Jesse Blackadder called 60 Seconds. It is an intense family drama exploring the impact on a family when tragedy strikes. Also later on in the show, I'm going to be introducing you to a fantastic new Australian author, MJ Chia, and her mystery novel, She Be Damned. We're going back to Victorian London with an absolutely brilliant new detective. I'm going to leave a little bit of surprise in there, but it is well worth sticking around. I loved this book, and I'm really excited to be bringing it to you. That is all on the show. Final Draft is books, writing, and literary culture. And we've got the books coming up after a very short break.
Experience the energy, tastes, and sounds of Thai culture at the Parramatta Loy Krathong Festival on Saturday, November 11 from 4 p.m. Featuring live entertainment from local and international performers, free workshops and activities, and an array of Southeast Asian street food. Launch your Krathong on the Parramatta River and make a wish for good fortune. Visit parramattaloykrathong.com.au. City of Parramatta sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You're on 2SER 107.3. I'm Andrew Popel, and you are tuned in to Final Draft. It's a half hour of books, writing, and literary culture every Saturday morning. Right now, I have an interview brought to us from Final Draft producer Jennifer Worgan. 60 Seconds is a novel from Jesse Blackadder, and it is a story about family tragedy. I'm going to let Jen tell you a little bit more about it.
The novel tells the story of the Brennan family, who are struck by tragedy after their 2-year-old son, Toby, drowns in their family pool. Parents, Finn and Bridget, and son, Jarrah, try to process their grief and loss while also dealing with the question of who is to blame. Thanks so much for speaking with us today, Jesse.
That's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Jennifer.
So there's so much to talk about with this book, but I would actually like to start with the structure, because the novel is written from three different points of view, and the chapters shift between the perspectives of the mother Bridget, father Finn, and son Jarrah. What made you choose to use this approach rather than following a single character?
One of the things that was so strong for me when I started to write this book was the notion of how the same experience can be completely different for different people. And it felt to me that the strongest way of telling that was to really follow the three completely different characters. And you know, if you can imagine that, you know, the setup of the book is the death of a child, and how different that will be for, you know, a parent who may or may not have some responsibility in it, a parent who's trying to protect the rest of the family, and a sibling who has a very strong connection. So Jarrah's the 15-year-old sibling who adored his younger brother, and really his life was completely turned upside down by this tragedy, and I wanted to really show how the characters misunderstand each other. They kind of get on their own track with what happens, and that, you know, lose awareness of the different experiences of each other in grief.
Yeah, definitely. And they do really process their grief in very different ways. And in many ways, I felt like the sense of isolation of each of the characters was very strong.
That's right. And really, it's the story of a family and their possible survival after a huge tragedy. So that's almost the narrative drive of the book. Can this small and now reduced family of three people possibly survive this tragedy intact? Can they actually get through it and survive without breaking apart into a million pieces?
Yeah. And I feel like the structure brings a lot to that. I was wondering, did you find that any of the points of view came more naturally to you during the writing process?
The point of view of Jarrah came very strongly, and perhaps because, you know, this book was informed by an experience in my own life when I was a child, which was my own sister drowning.
Mm.
And so I suppose I felt quite a kinship with Jarrah as a young person who, you know, this tragedy happened in his family. So his voice felt very vivid and alive to me, and that was one reason I wrote it in first person. You know, it just really came in such an immediate first person way. And I think, yeah, the parents of necessity were a little bit more distant for me because probably for me Jarrah was the major character.
Yeah. So this novel, as you just said, was inspired by an event in your own life. How did you navigate the process of taking a real experience, and especially such a tragic one, and then translating it into a creative, like, fictional work?
Well, I have to say it was an incredibly long process to do that. So I wrote my first novel, I guess you could say, that had this event in it when I was 28.
So okay.
A while ago. And, and really I was still a very new, immature writer when I did that. And so I wrote the story very much as it happened.
Okay.
I didn't proceed with publishing that story at the time. And now it's sort of 20 or 30 years down the track, and I felt like I had the maturity as a writer to not just write a story that was thinly disguised version of what I had gone through, but actually it's like the story had distilled in me over all of those years, and I could write something that was not my own story.
Yeah.
And not my own family story, but it drew on that emotional experience.
Was there ever any tension, even with the time that had passed, between writing something that was more, that felt factually correct or more true to your experience, or writing what was better for the fictional story? Or did they feel completely different?
But by the time I wrote it, they did feel different. So I think I really was able to approach 60 Seconds completely as a work of fiction, while it had a lot of emotional truth in it. But in terms of structuring the story and creating a narrative that was going to be really satisfying and really take a reader on a journey, I guess that's where I really realised enough time had passed. I wasn't trying to fit in what had really happened. I was really able to just write a story that had emotional truth in it, but was a work of fiction.
Definitely. I think the book was definitely very powerful and felt very emotionally true. So it was definitely successful in that. To change the subject a little bit, your last two novels for adults, The Raven's Heart and Chasing the Light, were both historical fiction novels set in Scotland and Antarctica, respectively. So what made you decide it was time to return to contemporary Australia to write 60 Seconds?
Well, for me, when a novel presents itself, when the idea for a novel comes, it often comes in quite a forceful way, and, you know, the choice is either am I going to write this or am I going to write nothing, because this is the idea that is presenting itself and knocking at the door in a very strong way. So I just had a very strong moment of realising, like it was like a bucket of cold water over me moment, of realising it was time to write a novel about a family whose child drowned. And the very next moment I just thought, oh no, really? Really? It's almost, I do believe that the story calls on you as a writer, and then you choose whether you're going to answer the call or not. And they were the three stories that really called to me, those three adult books. So, you know, one about the first women to go to Antarctica, I felt very, very drawn to that place and that story. And the one set in 16th century Scotland was about my Blackadder ancestors and their loss of their lands and their castle. And when I visited there, I felt very compelled again to tell that story.
Wow. So it's the same for every novel. There's a bucket of cold water feeling.
And look, sometimes it takes a little bit longer to happen. I think with 60 Seconds, it was a real moment. Like I can literally pinpoint the moment. And with other books, you know, sometimes, for example, when I found the old Blackadder Castle in Scotland, I didn't think straight away, oh, here's my next book. It probably took me a couple of months of coming back and letting the story settle and then thinking, actually, I think that might be what I'm going to write about.
It is pretty cool that you're ancestors owned a castle as well.
I know, it's and it was really cool to find the ruins of it. You know, it was just,
yeah,
it was just a pile of stones, but it was very haunting and it did really affect me.
Yeah, I feel like that would be affecting. Leading on from that, setting seems to play a huge role in your novels, and especially in this one. The book is set in the subtropical town of Murwillumbah in northeastern New South Wales. Why did you choose Murwillumbah as the setting for the novel?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, I suppose, is that I live down the road from Murwillumbah, about 45 minutes away. But that wasn't the primary reason. The main reason was there's this incredible sort of geographic landform, if you like. So Murwillumbah is located just near the base of what's known as Mount Warning or Wollumbin, which is the core of an ancient and massive volcano. And the edges of that volcano, it spans about 40 kilometres across, and so it really runs through this whole region of northeast New South Wales.
Oh, wow.
I think it's a very powerful place to be inside a volcano, and you can see the core of it still rising up, and you can see in a very eroded form the old rim of the volcano all around you, and I think that's really profound. So
wow.
For some reason I was really drawn to that notion of this is the cauldron in which a story will happen. I guess I was also exploring that romantic Australian idea of the sea change, you know, sort of dropping out of, you know, a cold place or a city or something and coming to the subtropics and the beautiful life that would therefore result, which of course is not always true.
Yeah. I think it was interesting that you mentioned the volcano as well, because I felt like there was a lot of reference to kind of oppressive heat in the book related to the weather, or maybe it was just an impression I got. But it's interesting that was also kind of coming from below.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's right. The family moved from Hobart, which was, you know, kind of cold and, you know, came into this hot landscape in which, you know, things happened, reactions happened, chemistry happened in quite an out-of-control way, I suppose.
And you are tuned into Final Draft. This is 2SER 107.3. I'm Andrew Popel, and right there you were listening to Final Draft producer Jennifer Worgan in conversation with Jesse Blackadder. Jesse's new novel is 60 Seconds, and it is a real examination of family drama and how we cope with tragedy. Now, right now, we are going to take a track. I have a little bit of a break with some music. Machine Translations have a new album out. It's called O, and we're going to take a track from it before coming back with my interview with MJ Chia about her debut novel, She Be Damned. Stick around for this one. I loved this book. I'm really excited to be sharing it with you. But right now, from Machine Translations, this is Sola.
Sola, just a walk in the park. 3 a.m. scary, wet and dark. Hands on fire, mind like a gun. Burning bridges, that's some fun. Now she's watching through a hole in the sun. Now she's watching through a hole in the sun. Till this human race is run.
I'll take you.
I'll take you.
House Cult Film Classics return to Event Cinemas George Street, November 24, with The Warriors. These are the armies of the night. They are 60,000 strong.
Warriors, come out to play.
Hosted by Seven's Jabba and Quinny from Supernova. Check the full In the House program and grab tickets at eventcinemas.com.au. Event Cinemas George Street, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, and I am Andrew Popel. I have an absolutely fantastic book to bring for you today, She Be Damned by MJ Chia. And She Be Damned opens on Victorian London in its heyday. As the city expands and the population booms, London is a city divided. Society doyens need never bother themselves that women are being brutally killed and mutilated across the river in Waterloo. Eloise Chauncey lives with a foot in both worlds. Styling herself a courtesan, she works for her intellectual pleasure as a private detective and is drawn into the gruesome murders when the daughter of a gentleman goes missing. So begins what promises to be a new series exploring the world of Victorian London through the eyes of a fantastic new hero, Eloise Chauncey, and I am joined by the author, Mirandi Riwo, on the line from the Sunshine State, which is a far cry from the fog-filled streets of 1860 London. Mirandi, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Andrew.
It is, it's an absolute pleasure. I hope you got from that introduction that you really immersed me in this world.
That's great.
I think a lot of people love Victorian London. I mean, it never seems to lose its luster, particularly the seedier underbelly and its penchant for crime. Now, these days, we've got enough Sherlock Holmes kicking around in the world that they could form their own Avengers team. What did you want to bring to this era and its crime fiction?
I guess for me, I wanted to bring female protagonists. Of course, there were female protagonists and female crime writers in the Victorian period that have become a bit lost, what with Sherlock Holmes and other protagonists like him. So I wanted to bring some characters that were female and also of maybe culturally hybridised to the period that we don't read about a lot in crime fiction or other fiction.
We open with Heloise established both as a prominent, if notorious, member of London society, but also established in her work of private detection. Did you want this history that we've got in Heloise to figure into your novels?
Absolutely. So the idea is throughout the series, we will definitely find out more about her and how she became a courtesan, where she's from, her heritage, I guess, and we'll also find out more about the Chinese character, Ama Li Lin, her maid.
We're going back 150-odd years in She Be Damned. Certainly, roles for women were circumscribed by society, but also by culture. Why this particular profession for Eloise?
Courtesans of the period, usually, you know, when you read about them or, you know, how they are portrayed in plays or movies, they usually die in the end or, you know, they're tragedies or they are depicted in romances. If you read about courtesans, they achieved a high level of independence and wealth that other, especially working class women, would never dream of achieving. You know, and they had celebrity in the period. I guess I wanted to portray that their sort of level of independence as an ability to be a sleuth as on the side. So I've just tried to portray her as a sort of gutsy woman. I've set her, she's based on a character called, not a character, a courtesan called Catherine Walters, who there's still a plaque on her house in Mayfair as the last Victorian courtesan.
The crimes in She Be Damned are particularly brutal. It's probably appropriate, actually, right now that I put a bit of a language warning on our conversation. We might be discussing some graphic content here, and sensitive ears might want to tune out for a few minutes. Eloise is brought in to investigate the disappearance of the daughter of a gentleman. It comes in the context of women being murdered around the Waterloo area, but they're not just being killed, they're targeted and brutalised. It struck me how very much this connects with a lot of contemporary conversations about the way power and sexual violence are used against women as a form of control and subjugation. Did any of that thinking come into your crafting of She Be Damned?
Oh, that's definitely where I was coming from in that, you know, violence against women is so prevalent and why, you know, and continues to this day. It was, you know, then and now. But what I was especially trying to show, I guess from a, you know, in sort of feminist crime writing, was as opposed to the clinical detective just looking at these bodies or, you know, dead women or brutalized women, like you said, I wanted to see it also from maybe the victim's point of view, but also through Heloise, a sort of subjective, her subjective reaction to such violence against women. And that's what I've tried to portray in this this novel. Also, I have to say, I can see that it seems very Jack the Ripper-ish, but actually what I guess inspired the type of murders was that I was reading about that there was a certain doctor or a certain sort of group of doctors in the Victorian period who performed genital mutilations on women to cure their hysteria. And I do touch on that in the book. And I think, you know, going, because it's a neo-Victorian crime fiction that's supposed to sort of touch on contemporary concerns as well. Of course, at the moment, there is sort of anxieties still regarding female genital mutilation. So that's actually why the murders are how they are.
You mentioned Jack the Ripper there. And look, while it had occurred to me, I felt like, if anything, the way that your crimes and the Ripper crimes had any overlap for me was the really wonderful way you throw up villains. I felt like in the world that you've created, there was a surplus of potential villains. And in fact, a lot of the men and their attitudes are villainous, even if they don't end up being the killer.
That's right.
Yeah. What though for you is the key to successful suspense? You had me hanging just on the fact that it could have been any of these, say, bastards. I've already put a language warning on it.
Well, I guess for me, I always wanted to write crime fiction in that sort of clue puzzle manner, like Agatha Christie's. So I guess really at the end of the day, I just wanted a lot of suspects and red herrings because, you know, at heart, it's a murder mystery. It's a crime fiction.
And the different, as I said before, the different bastards that you introduce, and the Ripper was really, you know, it enthralled people because there were all these suspicions that it could have been a doctor or a member of the aristocracy. Is it just that men were villainous back then, or is there something about the attitudes that lent them to the potential for violence?
I guess as a writer and reader of crime fiction, you know, that sort of violence, murders that have that level of violence, normally you would think just for purely going by strength, you would think maybe a man, and statistically, of course, it is mostly men who do those sort of murders. But I think in that novel I did try to hint it could have been one or two women. For, you know, just like I said, I just needed a lineup of suspects, the usual suspects.
It occurs to me too, Mirandy, that we're going to be having another conversation in a year or two's time of a future Heloise mystery, and it will finally be a female murder, and you're going to like, well, I've been foreshadowing it for such a long time.
Well, I have to say, because people obviously do ask me a lot about, you know, the female victims, my next novel, which is out next July, features many dead men, if that's anything.
Hooray for that. That's good. No, we need a few of them.
Shared it around.
Now, putting all this brutality aside, and we shouldn't be chuckling, but we are, I feel like sometimes we romanticise the past, and let's say it, because we're discussing London, we whitewash it. You've touched on the character of Amar. She's a beguiling figure cast against Heloise's, I'd say, more prominent heroism. You catch her in mystery, and it's revealing it through this first-person narrative interludes. And you also subject her to the most appalling racism at the hands of white Londoners. Why was it important to you to explore this aspect of the Victorian world?
Well, I guess you know, I'm of Asian heritage myself, so I'm interested in writing these culturally hybridized characters, such as Amar Lee Lean. I obviously, in writing that about characters like that, I would feel that it's, you know, that I should maybe write about racism, and of course racism then that might reflect racism now. I think that's what I've tried to do. I've also tried to maybe talk back or write back to the sinister Oriental or the sinister Asian that features so prominently in crime fiction, especially from that period, that sort of Fu Manchu. And it continues now, even if you look at neo-Victorian TV programs, even Sherlock Holmes, they still use that sort of mysterious sinister Asian. So I just wanted to write a character who maybe had a more mundane reason for being, you know, and lifestyle in London.
If we consider the historical context, this is 150-odd years ago, the world that Eloise and Amar, who's a bit older than her, would have grown up in is very much the world that Australia as a country kind of emerged from. And yes, the attitudes carried over the water as Australia was invaded and colonised. Do you think it's important for us to reconcile ourselves to these negative, these dirty, these, you know, downright racist parts of our history for our current era? Like, can we move on as a country and as a world if we don't acknowledge, hey, we were pretty racist once upon a time?
We were very racist. In fact, my next historical fiction that's not crime fiction, I've set in the Gold Rush in northern Queensland. And obviously, and it's about a Chinese gold digger, so obviously the racism has to be touched upon, and of course to Indigenous people as well. I think I would want to touch on it now. I think it's pertinent and valuable because I personally think that maybe that form of racism is peaking again or becoming worse again. So I think there is a space for writing about it and where it might have come from and how it improved for a while and might be getting worse again.
Yeah, I think it's actually a really awesome thing that you're doing here and very much, I think, a part of our current illusion that perhaps we are a thoroughly open and welcoming country is that we've convinced ourselves that that's the way it's always been and we ignore this racism. So I really loved that aspect of She Be Damned.
Oh, thank you, Andrew.
There's so much, I guess there's so many other little elements, but the key to any mystery is that we don't go too much into spoiler territory. Yeah, but it's really been wonderful to chat this through, and I guess it's easy to kind of play up the idea of a really powerful, prominent female detective and play up the feminism side of it and lose sight of the fact that this is just a fun story.
Obviously, I wanted to look at those sort of themes to do with sexuality and racism, but at the end of the day, I wanted it to be a bit of a romp for the reader.
If you are intrigued, the mystery we are discussing is She Be Damned by MJ Chia. MJ Chia is also Mirandi Ruot, and I've been speaking to her. Mirandi, thank you so much for taking us into your Victorian London.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Thank you.
My name's Andrew Popel. It is so exciting to bring you books every week. I'm going to come back and do it next week. But I have to say goodbye right now. I want to say thank you to Jessie Blackadder for sharing her book 60 Seconds, MJ Chia for She Be Damned. And also want to say thank you to Jennifer Worgan who brought us that interview with Jessie Blackadder. Right now it's time for The Vulture's Nest. My name is Andrew Popel. I'm going to say goodbye. But I will be back next week with more books. See you later.